We've come to North Hollywood. Is this North Hollywood?
No, this is West Hollywood.
West Hollywood. Yes. Well, Hollywood is so
North
big.
North Hollywood is out in the valley.
Oh, well, this is West Hollywood. Uh-huh. And this is between Hollywood and Beverly Hills.
Yes.
That's right. The voice you're hearing is that of Loreen Tuttle, a very famous voice from not only the quote-unquote golden age of radio, but from the golden age of television, too.
Mm-hmm. And I was in the golden age of theater, too.
Were you?
Because I started in the theater in 1926. I was a full-fledged leading lady in 1928. And quite young to be a leading lady, mm-hmm. you know, because I went to San Antonio, Texas when I was 20 or 21, and became a leading lady in very heavy drama and heavy acting. So from then on, I went to several places in the theater. I went to Portland, Oregon. I went to Salt Lake City and became a famous leading lady in that town in those days. They were fine stock companies in those days. You know, I wish we had them now for young people to grow in. Because you don't have that kind of thing anymore, where you get money for learning. You see, these days you have to pay money to learn.
How right you are.
Yes,
yeah.
In little theaters and any kind of theaters now. But in those days, you got good money. I was very proud of my position in the theater.
Did you get to Broadway at all?
No, I never did. I was asked several times, but then I always had something here. I seemed to always have a contract that wouldn't let me out of it or something. Because when I started in radio, then I really got involved. Mm-hmm. And I would so many times be under contract to three or four companies at the same time. The Sam Spade Show, when after a while, I think about the second year, I got involved with the Red Skelton Show.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't stay there to do the Sam Spade Show. So I would have to put my work, our opening, dear little opening scene and our closing scene, on record, or so, no, it wasn't tape, it was record. And we would put that on during rehearsal, and then I'd go and do the Red Skelton Show. So I really wasn't there for the actual showing. They would just put my part on.
In other words, when the show... Well, they weren't in conflict with one another, were they? They weren't on
opposite. No, but my rehearsals were.
Oh, rehearsals. Oh,
I see. We would start to rehearse the Spade Show at 10 in the morning, and then I think we went on at 5 to 5:30 here, and then probably did... No, then they played a repeat, transcription record repeat. And so about 2, I had to go over to the Skelton Show. So they, between 1 and 2, and the others were sent out to lunch, or maybe 12, to, between 12 and 1... then I would, Howard would stay there with me, and we would tape, or rather record, my opening and closing stuff. And I have those, you know. I bought those little records, so I have them. I love to hear Effie and Sam. Oh, they're the most adorable love scenes ever written in the history of show business, I think.
Sam Spade, Howard Duff, remembers the license number of his car.
37596.
You can't forget it either.
No, sir.
Those were the days, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
Let's back up just a little bit now before Sam Spade. What was your very first radio role?
Well, a big radio role was the part of Ginny on the Hollywood Hotel show. I was chosen because I looked like and sounded as if I could be the speaking voice of a coloratura soprano. Ann Jameson was chosen to play the singing role of Ginny opposite Dick Powell. So she wasn't an actress, so I was chosen to be her speaking voice. So all of the lovely operettas that we did, I was the leading lady opposite Dick Powell. So that was a marvelous way to start radio because it was Leeds, you know. I had come right from stock company Leeds, from the theater Leeds, so I wasn't ill at ease in these things, you know. See, it was just easy for me, and we had an audience out there. It was like working, except that you had a script in your hand. Yeah. You didn't have to learn it. But it was the same kind of show business to me.
Luella Parsons was involved in that program,
wasn't she? You bet she was. I just found an album the other day. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard it yet, but there are some excerpts from the show, which I'd never heard in all these years. I don't know that anybody ever took any. At least I didn't have
Most of the
any.
Time, it was just as you were saying about the Sam Spade, where you and Howard Duff recorded the openings and the closings.
Yes.
The shows that were broadcast in the 30s and the 40s, many of them were not recorded for preservation purposes.
No, not at
they
all.
Were
they were live.
Right. They
Absolutely
were all live.
If you made a mistake, it was just too bad.
Some of those conversations on the air between you and Sam
were so funny.
Were great.
I listen to them now, and I know half of it was ad-lib. We were allowed to. And so many musicians used to come down and sit in the booth. I saw Sammy Davis recently, and he said, "Oh, I'll never forget when I was allowed to come there and sit in the booth and watch you and Howard do Sam Spade." And he said, I wasn't anybody then, and I wouldn't have been allowed in there if somebody hadn't taken me. But somebody took me by the hand and asked Bill Spear if I could come in and visit. And he said, I loved coming there. Louis Armstrong used to come and sit in the booth, and famous people were. It was a great privilege to be allowed to, because it wasn't a very big booth, you know. Yeah. They didn't have very
many
people.
And there was no audience, no studio audience.
No,
for this
not
show,
on that Sam. Show. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So the people who sat in the booth, and many times Howard and I would mention them. Mm-hmm. He would say, "Did you see Dizzy Gillespie the other day?" And I said, "What was he doing over there? I didn't see him." "I'm so glad you mentioned him, because, you know," and then we go on into something. It was so cute. And a lot of it was ad lib. I realize now when I hear some of them, because it was only, I think, about 13 weeks that I had to do that.
The doubling.
Uh-huh.
Well, what about the Red Skelton Show? Now, you played Junior's... When
Mummy.
Red was Junior, played Junior's mother.
Mummy, uh-huh.
Mummy,
she was always
right.
called
not,
Junior's
not
Mummy.
Not Mamaw. Mamaw was Verna Felton.
Yes, right.
You were Junior's Mummy.
Uh-huh. And I played Daisy June, his girlfriend. Uh-huh. That was Clem Cadiddlehopper's girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And I played Mrs. Willie Lump Lump. He was the drunk.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And I played a lot of other parts on the show. I have some of those tapes, and they're fun to listen to.
You were
I really think Red Skelton should get out a lot of his tapes and play them again, because I really think his show was always better on radio than it ever was on TV.
Well, that's the old
Just
story
funnier.
Of...
To me, it was funnier.
Story of the imagination again.
Absolutely.
See?
Uh-huh.
When you,
especially Junior.
Yeah. Oh, well, see, you couldn't do Junior on television.
No, yeah. He never did. Yeah. Never.
He tried to work it into a monologue occasionally, and he would often talk about his son, his little boy at the time, but it just didn't work the way it did. How long were you with Red?
7 years.
Did you take over the characterizations on that show after Harriet Hilliard was on the show with
Red? Yes,
she
was on.
Ozzie too,
and then Gigi Pearson was on, and then I was about the third one. I loved working on that show. Oh, it was fun. Red ad-libbed a lot, too. But he always came back to the cue. He would wander far away from the script, and then he'd always come back so you'd know when to, you know, when you were supposed to talk.
I have a feeling that a lot of Red Skelton's ad-libs were calculated. Are the cops coming after us now?
No, the fire engine is right up there.
Oh, we're right down the
street. I bless it, you know. It goes by quite often, but I don't mind. It doesn't bother me.
Well, we're... Actually, your home here doubles. I want to get back to your career too, but doubles as a studio.
Oh my, yes.
Because let's go way out of context. We're out of chronological order here anyway. What are you doing today?
Well, I've just finished a marvelous part on Medical Center. Mm-hmm. See, I work all the time. I've done a nice thing, a very good part with Michael Callan on This Is the Life. It's a religious thing that goes on at 4 o'clock, at least here on Sunday on NBC. It's a good show too. Very well done, very well directed, and I had a lovely part on that. I do commercials and I do everything. I was supposed to go to San Simeon, up where the Hearst Castle is, and do The Corn Is Green this month, September. But the lady who was the director and the impresario there has been ill, so I'm not going to go up to do that until maybe later in the year. But I do theater, I do everything. I do radio, you know. We still have a C.P. McGregor show.
Yes,
I think Howard Duff does that.
Heartbeat Theater, isn't it?
Yes, I'm sure you've talked to the people on that.
Yes, yes. But what do you do right here in your studio?
Oh, I teach acting, yes. As a matter of fact, we might mention this fact. I think it's lovely that you happened to come in when Bob Birdsong was here, and he is Mr. Universe. I have worked on tape with some of the finest athletes in the business. I had the privilege, I would call it a privilege, because he was so marvelous to work with Floyd Patterson. He was trying out for a part in a movie. Mm-hmm. And I've worked with Bob Segrin, the hurdler. Hurdler, what is it? My goodness. The tallest one.
Oh. Basketball?
No.
I'm so far out on the sports.
Oh, I'll think of it in a second. It's not hurdler. And I've worked with, let me see now, who else in the athletic line? I can't think of anybody right now.
Well, people come to you to...
pole vaulting. Bob Seguin is the champion pole vaulter, yes.
People come to you for aid and assistance in the area of speech?
Yes, almost everything. You see, I cover everything. I've been in all kinds of show business. I've even been in vaudeville. And I've been in a circus, but I probably will. But I have done everything. So they come to me for any kind of help. I work a great deal with them on the tapes because if somebody, for instance, Bob Birdsong was born in Memphis, and he may want to get some of those Memphis sounds out, so that's what we're going to work on. If somebody has a thick Southern accent and they would rather he wouldn't talk so Southern, for instance, somebody might go into contract to Universal Studios and they would send them to me and say, take out some of the accent. So I do that a great deal. I was just listening to somebody on my tape who had a very thick Trinidad accent. Of course, that's something we have to work on, too. But I have a workshop, and I put on showings, very good showings, too, quite often. And I keep my people busy all the time. I have clever people who work in the business and who really are very talented. It's a joy to teach, a joy to direct.
They're all working with a very talented instructor, too.
Oh, thank you.
Let's get back to the development of your talents. On the Red Skelton show, we're talking about Red and his ad-libbing and all of that. I understand that he put on almost an after-show for the studio audience when the regular radio broadcast
was
done.
Yes, he did, at least an hour, sometimes an hour and a half. He got steamed up, you know, and the half-hour show didn't really satisfy him.
Uh-huh.
So he kept the audience there afterwards. See, we used to have a preview night, Thursday night. When we were on Fridays, we would have a preview on Thursday night, and he would go on and on and on and on. We'd have to stay there because we'd have to wait till this after show was over before we could listen to the record. And we would listen to the record to see how things went. And then we came back the next day and did the live show. Always live. I don't think I ever went on that we weren't live.
Yeah. You had to do two shows then, didn't you, for the West Coast and the East Coast?
No, in that case, no, because it was taken off on transcription and replayed. Many times we would do a 5 o'clock show, and that would be taken off on transcription and played later.
Oh, I see.
But in the old days, we did do two shows. Mm-hmm. We would have an afternoon show, a 5 o'clock show, or a 5:30 show, and then come back and do it again at 8:30. Mm-hmm. But those were a lot of audience shows, too. We would wear street clothes in the afternoon and come back and wear evening clothes.
Oh, yes,
it was a very glamorous business.
Two different audiences,
Over at the Huntington Hartford, when I go backstage there, I think of the many radio shows we used to do there. The Lux radio show went on there, and lots of radio shows went on because they were audience shows. That's why I felt that radio was not just a microphone working kind of show. It was audience participation. And
yet you worked before the mic and not before a live audience in many radio programs.
Oh, many, yes.
Too. Sam Spade, of course, was one. But you were, weren't you on the Great Gildersleeve at one time?
Yes, I was the original Margie.
You were? For Hal Perry, then.
Yes.
He was Gildersleeve.
Yes, I was on the opening show. And I worked on it for about 2.5 years, and then they kept writing Margie younger all the time. She got to be about 16. And I felt that was too difficult for me to go out in front of an audience, you know, and try to look 16. So I think I gave my notice on the show.
Were you on that pilot show for Johnson's Wax?
I expect so.
Because it was supposed to be a summer replacement for Johnson's Wax.
Uh-huh.
And then Johnson's decided against Gildersleeve, and then Kraft Foods came in and picked it up.
Oh, I see.
But
well,
you were
know more about
Kraft
than I do. But
the pilot show. I have. Uh-huh.
Well, I have lots and lots of tapes from things, you know. I buy the albums and I buy the tapes, so that it's fun to listen. And sometimes I hear things and don't remember doing it. I have a marvelous little mystery thing about a doll. I guess it was a hoodoo or voodoo doll. Mm-hmm. And it was beautifully done, and I can't even place the man's voice who did it with me. But it was a very exciting thing, and I've listened to it several times, and I like it very much. But I don't know when I did it, and I don't remember who did it with me.
Was it on a suspense?
No, it wasn't anything like that, because then that would be tabulated.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's just remote. It's just on a piece of tape, and somebody sent it to me.
Oh, I see.
A lot of people send things to me, you know. I'm grateful to get them, too, because sometimes I get something that I would like to keep, and I'm so happy
to get
it.
Well, we'll dig into our hall closet and see what we can come up with.
Maybe
and send
so.
You, some things,
you know, I have one with Gary Cooper. Mm-hmm. I have one with Cary Grant. I opened Suspense with Cary Grant. Black Curtain is the one I did with him, which is out on album. And I have one with Humphrey Bogart where he says to me, I want to see more of you, baby. My friends laugh. We love to listen to those things.
You were really all over radio,
weren't
you?
Oh, I should say I was. I used to do all kinds of voices, too. I still can. I can go down to McGregor and sometimes do a little tiny girl.
Could you give us a little girl?
Let me see. On a show over at CBS, Television City, I had to play a doll not too long ago. Let's see if I can get that voice again. Somebody pushed the little string on the doll, and I had to run upstairs and put my face into the microphone and be the doll while they were working the doll on the downstairs. Nobody knew the difference. Nobody knew I was doing it.
See, Howard Duff was right. He said, you have to talk to Lorene Tuttle because she's a doll.
Oh, how sweet. Oh.
See, it worked.
You know, he used to say such a cute thing. I used to ask questions on the show, on the rehearsal, for real, because I'm always saying, I don't understand this plot. I would always say to somebody, Howard or Bill Spear or somebody, I don't understand this plot. So they got to say, down, Effie. Down, Effie. And that's how that phrase got started. It was
down,
a real thing. You know, shut up, Effie.
You played the nurse on the Dr. Christian show for
a
while.
Yes, Judy Price.
Was that before or after Rosemary DeCamp came in on
it
that?
It was after. She got very busy in the picture business, so she sort of resigned for a while. But she came back. I just took over while she was busy, and then she came back. But that was a lovely thing to do. Gene Herschel was a fabulous man, lovely to work with.
The audience, they asked the audience to send in a story or a script.
Uh-huh.
They said it was the only show on radio where the audience wrote the script.
Yeah, they were lousy, too.
really
very amateurish.
How much tampering did the writers do with the audience scripts then? Quite a bit.
Well, you mean the real writers on the show?
Yeah.
Yes, well, they had to fix them quite often, a lot,
mm-hmm.
because they were really quite amateurish. But they had nice thoughts. They had nice plots.
Mm-hmm.
But they just needed fixing. The dialogue didn't work.
That's
too
the essential ingredient that a writer has to look for anyway, isn't it?
A good
storyline.
Yes.
Something to work with, and then they can pull it together. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the audience then did participate, even more so than using their imagination. Here they wrote the story.
You know, I would love to do radio again, but I would not want to do radio with some of the non-knowledgeable people running it. Because, you see, for instance, we'll take the show called The Frigidaire Show, which was directed by one of the best directors in the business, Bob Redd. We had the most beautiful orchestra in the world with all the finest musicians and a fine director, fine conductor. We had the best sound man. We had the best mixer. We had the best engineer. We had the best everything, and very carefully put together. Now, I'm afraid they'd be careless these days. I'm afraid they wouldn't realize the essence of perfection that you have to put into one of those things. And I would not like to see them do it unless they could go back to the old days of doing them properly.
Well, you see, you have at least 25, probably 30, or even 35 years in between today and the day when the people who were doing it really were day-to-day craftsmen at it. They knew what they're doing.
Yes.
And you talk about putting it all together. The sound effects in those days, in the 40s, for example, were made on the spot. Seldom did they use, they never used tape.
No.
Occasionally a record maybe with something, but almost always they created the sound on the spot. Today there isn't even that sound effects equipment around.
No.
Everything is on a little cartridge, a little taped cartridge, and they have to press buttons, and it doesn't work.
That essence,
it doesn't click that way, see?
And sound men used to do dogs, you know. I've got to tell you a funny story. Down on the Hollywood Hotel show, the sound man was supposed to do a little yipping, yappy dog, little tiny, you know, terrier, like a terrier. And he sounded like a big dog. He sounded like a Newfoundland dog or something. And the director kept saying that it won't do. It just can't. I can't have it. So Olivia de Havilland was sitting next to me, and she says, I can do a very good dog. And I said, well, I don't think they'll let you do a dog. This is an audience show. They won't let you. You're a star. You can't do a dog. And she says, I'm going to do it. So she went over to the director. She called him went in the booth. And she said, I'd like to try doing this dog for you. So they put her behind the screen, and she went on the show and did that yipping dog. Isn't that the cutest thing? I'll always remember that.
Did you ever do animals like that? You never did.
Not very
that
often.
Stuff.
I once did, for Lawrence and Lee, on a show, Alice in Wonderland, I did the Dormouse, the little Dormouse in the sugar bowl. Mm-hmm. And I gave a fabulous interpretation of that. I can't recreate it because I have to have the words to go with it. They wrote such a cute little sequence there. So I'd have to have the dialogue. But I've done animals, I have done, let me see, one of the most interesting things I did one time on a show was Barnum and Bailey's First Freak. It was an old lady, 120 years old or something like that, at least over 100, and she drank heavily, so she was full of gin. And let me see what other things I had to interpret. It seems to me I had three or four things that I had to, she was black. That's right, she was black. So I had to conjure up all those things to do at the microphone. And the people in the studio there were just bursting. You know, they wanted to laugh on the air, but they didn't dare.
You know, you remind me of an interesting point about radio. I've talked with a great many people who were on radio and made a living with it. And they said they loved it because it was very easy. You walk in and read the script and do it. But they really oversimplify because you say, well, it's easy, but if you're talented, it's easy. It may not even be that easy, even if you're talented. You have to be able to, with the dialogue that's there, maybe with a little bit of sound effect or music help, but you have to really convince the listener that you are what you're supposed to be.
You see, I always felt that we had to work with an all-physical person. There are very clever people in the business now who are just voice characters, who I would say turn on voice 36 or voice 9 or voice 12 or something. But we always worked from the full person, at least I did, and I know that all of us tried to work that way because that's the only honest way to do it. You have to have a person who lives and breathes and walks and is alive rather than just turning on a voice. Because you could conjure up, if you really had, through imagination, anything that you wanted to be. That's why I loved it, too. Because I could play opposite Jimmy Stewart or Frederick March or Cary Grant or Gary Cooper or Leslie Howard. And on the air, I could be the most glamorous, gorgeous, tall, black-haired female you've ever seen in your life. Whatever I wished to be, I could be with my voice. That was the thrilling part to me. I did several shows with Leslie Howard, who was a marvelous actor and a fine radio actor, too. I think I did intermezzo with him one time, playing the Ingrid Bergman part, which I wish, and I, wish on, I had a tape of that.
Must have been on the Lux.
No, Lux. I think it was on Academy Award or Frigidaire, one of those two.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because on the Lux radio theater, they always had the male and female star. But on the Frigidaire show or the Academy Award show, I would play opposite the big star. I would be going on for somebody else, like Ingrid Bergman or Irene Dunne or any female star. I did a lot of things with female stars and also male stars on Suspense, though. I worked one with Rosalind Russell and a marvelous one that I had with Joan Crawford, which was so good. Oh, she was so good. She was a good radio actress.
You were, too.
I loved it.
Still are.
Oh,
you worked with Kenny Baker on Glamour Manor, and they were on with Ann Southern and Maisie.
Yes.
And
you were involved. I was with, by the way, Errol Flynn. You know, that Casablanca thing that he did? I don't know that he was. No, he was called Casanova, I think. Casanova somebody. And I did Foreign Women with him. You know, I'd come in and do some marvelous Hungarian wench. And I remember
too.
Him. Yes. Oh, yes. And I remember Errol only as a very quiet, gentle, good actor who's very serious. I don't, when I read these things about what a wild man he was, I never saw him that way. I only see Errol as a symbol of excellence. in every way. How in the world he ever got a reputation as such a bounder or a libertine, I don't know, because I never saw him that way.
Well, you worked with him in a strictly professional relationship, and he was that all the time.
I used to love to work opposite Ronald Coleman, too. Mm-hmm. I have a picture, and I should show it to you. And it says, "Dear Loreen, thank you for pulling me through so many broadcasts. Fondly, Ronnie."
Oh.
Not Ronald Coleman, but Ronnie. Oh, it's very, it touches my heart.
Oh, I noticed a lot of photos on the wall in your apartment.
Oh, yes. I have a pile over there, you see, that's just filled with stars pictures.
All over the place. And all autographed, I'm sure, to you.
Oh, yes. I have one of Gregory Peck over there. I did a marvelous radio show with him.
I see a photo on your wall here of the... the family that lived with the father.
Oh, yes.
You were the mother in
yes,
Life
I
with
was.
Father on television.
Dear Vinny. Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, I've had such lovely things to play. You know, I love to talk about having gone from Life with Father, and she was just perfection, you know. She was the dearest, but also mischievous lady. Mm-hmm. She had a lot of little plans and schemes and things, which were cute. But she was a very interesting person to play. And then after that was off the air, I did Ma Barker. You know, I did a movie called Ma Barker and Her Killer Brood. And I had those terrible gangster sons. Ma Barker taught, as she called him, Johnny Dillinger how to shoot. You know, she was a character she was. And I loved playing her. I didn't have any problem shooting my machine gun. Hedda Hopper told me one time that the reason I loved shooting that gun was because I was after a lot of people. maybe mad at times. I don't know. I don't remember being very mad at anybody.
When did you first get into television? Probably when television first came in.
Yes. I think one of the first shows I did in television was the Dennis Day show. Mm-hmm. I played his future mother-in-law. Which was a kind of a character that was fun to do because she was kind of mean to him. It was fun to do. I had some awfully good roles to play in television when it first came out. It was very interesting for me. I didn't care too much for the live shows. I did a lot of those matinees.
The matinee theater broadcast?
Uh-huh, with dear Al McCleary. I enjoyed those very much, and they were all big roles, very interesting things.
And then in 1953, I guess it was, the Life with Father series.
Yes.
With Leon Ames and good cast.
Leon and I have done the play, you know, twice.
Have you? Since?
Since the show went off the air. Uh-huh. We did it at the Pasadena Playhouse, and we did it in Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. And it was lovely to do. As a matter of fact, some interesting things have come from the plays. We did the play in Pasadena, and Ben Murphy... and Michael Gray, who are both big in the business now, you know, Ben Murphy works all the time, and Michael Gray is on that Shazam show. Mm-hmm. They were in the cast. One played Clarence Jr., and little Michael played John. Then we went to Santa Barbara, and all the Bottoms boys were in the picture.
Oh, yeah.
Timothy and Sam and Joe, all of them. I think there was another fourth. I think he played Whitney or Harlan. They were all in it, too. So we've kind of launched some interesting people with our Life with Father show.
That was the riding very big in for a couple of years on television at this just after I think Mama was
yes,
on.
Yes, that's
so
my
television,
mama.
You know, now here's television that's really good warm shows. Mama and Life with Father, they had the whole family covered there.
Mm-hmm.
They don't seem to make them with that kind of warmth anymore.
I wish they'd bring back Life with Father. They have 26 films. Mm-hmm. They made a year and a half of live shows, which were Kinney's, and those are not usable. But then we went over to a studio and made 26 films, and they could be played. I wish some very alert sponsor would come along and pick up those shows, because I really think in black and white they'd even be more interesting than if they were in color. We did do one color show, but I think that was on Kinescope.
Mm-hmm.
But the films would play very well, I would think.
Oh, sure. Well, I think, you know, it's always interesting to see those shows again. And it's just like the movies on television, and you're standing up and watching the Late Late Show. They're just as good as they were in the first time around.
Absolutely.
The fact that they're 15 or 35 years old doesn't make any difference. Mm-hmm. You know?
1953, that's quite a ways back.
Oh, that's just yesterday, isn't it?
When I think of all of the ground I've covered and all the parts I've played, I don't know that there's anything I haven't played, really. I just have, I've certainly run the gamut of all kinds of characters.
What else did you do in the movies? You were Ma Barker, you said. That wasn't a telefilm, was it? It was a motion picture.
Oh, no, it was a motion picture. Yeah. Oh, yes. Well, I played Jack Lemmon's mother in the Fortune Cookie. And I was just... many people have called me and said that they saw me on a show with Joan Crawford, Goodbye, My Fancy, where I had a very cute part. And I've just done two Walking Talls. You know, I was in the original Walking Tall with Joe Don Baker. And then I just, we did it in Tennessee, in Jackson, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And I did the second installment of Walking Tall. So those are my two latest movies. I can't think. Let's see, what did I do? After the Fortune Cookie. Oh.
Well, we got the telephone. We'll take a quick break. We're talking about her career with Lorene Tuttle in West Hollywood, California.
Yes.
And she's got a letter from a fan who just recently wrote that they wrote for an autograph, didn't they, and a photo?
Yes, and a photograph.
And they listed your movies.
Yes, I guess I don't have a recent listing of the very latest ones I've done, but this is the list that this dear man has put down. Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House, Macbeth, that was with Orson Welles, mm-hmm. Goodbye, My Fancy, with Joan Crawford, Tomorrow Was Another Day, Room for One More, Don't Bother to Knock, that was with Marilyn,
mm-hmm.
and Marilyn Monroe, Niagara, which was with Marilyn Monroe, Never Wave at a Whack, with Rosalind Russell, The Glass Slipper, with Leslie Caron, Sincerely Yours, with Liberace. Slander, with Van Johnson, Untamed Youth, with Mamie Van Dorn, Sweet Smell of Success, with Burt Lancaster and
Tony
Curtis.
Uh-huh.
Psycho.
Not going to tell me you were Tony Perkins' mother.
No, that was Jeanette Nolan. No, I played John McIntyre's wife. Isn't that funny?
Oh.
She was the lady on the tape, or however they played her.
Mm-hmm.
And I was John McIntyre's wife. I was the sheriff's wife. The Ghost of Mr. Chicken with Don Knotts, which has been played quite a bit recently. The Fortune Cookie with Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon. And The Horse in the Gray Flannel Suit, which was with Dick Jones. It was over at Disney. So I have done some very... I just realized now I've done some very interesting pictures.
You certainly have.
But I can't remember any recent ones except Walking Tall, and I guess that is the most recent one.
Well, that's just
one.
Being released
yes,
now.
Yes, the second one. The second,
yeah,
one,
second
is
one is
just coming out now. Well, I found that letter.
Earlier you said you had been in everything but the circus, included vaudeville. What did you do in vaudeville?
I did five performances a day, vaudeville, down at the RKO Theater with Lila Bliss and Harry Hayden and Melville Ruick, to whom I was married at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a vaudeville sketch. It was a comedy sketch. And I loved it because it was fun. You go to your dressing room and you just get your breath and you go on again. Five a day.
Born in the trunk, almost.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it was fun.
You enjoyed your show business career, haven't you?
Oh, I should say I have.
And I'm still enjoying it.
Yes. I one of the reasons, too, that I loved radio so much was because I always played opposite a very big star.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't always happen now in TV. I just thoroughly enjoyed working with Chad Everett, for goodness sake, in Medical Center. But... I don't play opposite them the way I used to. You see, it was quite a thrill to play opposite Paul Muni on a show and have a role that was commensurate with his, you know, to realize that you were co-starring with somebody who was supposedly, a really big star. And they were just wonderful. For instance, I did A Star is Born with Frederick March. I did the Judy Garland part. And I did One Sunday Afternoon with James Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
So I had, beautiful moments to remember. And I have them many of them on tape so that I can recreate them in my mind, how exciting they were.
That's nice to have those.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. See, they don't write really meaningful women's parts anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. Women are kind of discarded. We're just kind of pushed in the background a lot. They don't have the warm grandmas and aunts and people that they used to have always in a script. There was almost always a grandpa or an aunt or an uncle or somebody of an older generation. But nowadays, they don't bring them in. I think younger people these days are really a little bored with their with older people. I think they're only happy with them, with their peers.
Well, do you think that the reason that we don't find these extra roles in the, we're talking about movies and television today, of the aunts and the grandmas and the older neighbors, though, wouldn't you say that's all a matter of dollars and cents? They say we don't need another person in there.
Yes, I could. That could be.
We don't have the time in a half-hour show.
True. We have to show all the bad people, not so many of the good people. Bad people are more interesting, evidently.
Women were responsible in many cases on radio, though, for some of the most dynamic shows on the air.
My,
I mean,
yes.
Look at the Agnes Moorehead and the Sorry Wrong Number from
yes.
Suspense
uh-huh.
and others like that. Did you ever do any one-woman roles on radio?
Not all by myself. I did, just noticing the other night in my scrapbook, on The Whistler, I did twins. I did a good girl and a bad girl, and it was interesting because I had different microphones, you know, one for the good girl and another microphone for the bad girl, so that I had really a different sound of two people. And that was almost a tour de force. It was almost all by myself. There weren't very many people, more people in the cast.
Did you turn from one mic to
mm-hmm.
the next then?
Mm-hmm.
But they were side by side.
Uh-huh. But that's interesting.
Was that an aid to you to have the two mics there to keep your
roles
separate?
Oh, yes, because it was like night and day.
Uh-huh.
These two persons were different, entirely different, even though they were twins. One was evil, mm-hmm. and I felt, you know, I had the time to physically become the other person as I moved from microphone to microphone. I had to. My imagination has always been very strong. From the time I was able to talk. See, my father, I had a stage father. Most people have stage mothers.
Uh-huh.
I had a stage father, and he put me on performing when I was just able to talk. So I performed, and I've been acting since I was a year old. So it's never been anything but just joy and part of life to be acting. I wouldn't think that I could do anything else. Although, when I got out of high school, I decided to work in a store. And I was only 17.
Mm-hmm.
And I sold so much and had so many friends coming in buying stuff in this store. It was out in Monrovia at McBratney's store. And so many people came in, and I brought in so much trade that he decided that I could be the buyer of the whole department. Well, that was too much for me. I said, oh, no, I'm going off to college now. Sorry, can't do that. But it was lovely. An actress, you see, should be a perfectionist. An actress should have the epitome of belief in themselves. They should always do things well.
People have said to me about you that you are a pretty good historian and documentarian.
I have everything written down. From 1937, I have every show I ever did and the amount of money I got for it. So I could, you know, I could count up someday how much money I made in the radio business. It would be scary, wouldn't it? But I have it all written down, all tabulated, mm-hmm. so that if anybody says, what show did you do on August the 12th, 1942, I have it. And they can't mm-hmm. fool me on it. If anybody wants to fight with me on it,
it's right there.
I can take it right to the government.
Do you think you could find the date of a show? For example, if we were looking for, we have a suspense program
uh-huh.
with Lorene Tuttle, but we don't have a date.
I probably could.
If I got a title...
Oh, yes, I'd have the date.
You would be able to say
yes.
date it was
and
how much you got for it.
Oh, definitely.
May I ask a couple questions about that? I don't want to add up all of the money, how much you've earned in your radio career.
Oh, let's don't. I'd faint.
I would faint. How much would you earn for a suspense program as a guest?
Not very much. You see, the stars came in well backed up by a studio.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, we'll take James Stewart. He would come in and get at least $3,000, maybe $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
And my price would be $55. That was almost always the way. The radio person hardly ever got very much over scale. I didn't fight for it because I liked volume. That's the way I made mm-hmm. Lots mm-hmm. of money, by being on a lot of shows. I didn't hold out for a lot of over scale money. But I worked a lot, and, you know, you add up about 10 $55 shows, and you're not making bad money.
That's right.
So I worked it that way, just by volume.
Were you working for overscale with Red Skelton, though?
Not much.
Not
I don't think much.
Uh-huh.
More than
supporting.
About $25, maybe,
uh-huh.
overscale.
Mm-hmm.
I probably got $125 for that show. You know, even though I was there 2 days, mm-hmm. maybe I was there Thursday and Friday, and on Sunday I could have been there all day Saturday and all day Sunday. Mm-hmm. But I probably just got about 150, mm-hmm. maybe we'll say 150.
And while you were ad-libbing with Howard Duff, about the same, I suppose. Huh?
Yes, I think it finally got up to 90, maybe 100 and a quarter, but not ever over that. Howard got a lot more than I did. Mm-hmm. You see, I still say it's a man's world. A man can get more money than a woman. You know, I'm not a woman's liver because I don't like that type of person. Mm-hmm. I think that we shouldn't shout and get very ugly about asking for favors. But I do think it's rather strange that a man getting a job will get more money than a woman, always.
Is this still the case when AFRA came in and equalized
yes.
the salaries? Even a man, but you say the star would demand more, wouldn't he?
Always,
he would get more,
uh-huh.
I see, yeah.
Uh-huh. And in the case of Howard Duff, you know, naturally, mm-hmm. he mm-hmm. would, because he was the star of the show. See, they have made
but
a lot.
But he had to be there live every week. You just recorded your stuff.
Well,
and
only
cut
13
out.
Weeks, though. 3 years of it, I was on there live with him. Yeah. But it was just those 13 weeks that I had to go over and do the skeleton show.
That was good. They would permit that.
I know it. Well, Bill Spear mm-hmm. was just dear about it. Mm-hmm. Effie, I think, was one of the dearest people I've ever played in my life because she was patient. She always waited for him to come back. And I think people were very aware of the fact that he chased around quite a bit, but he always came back to Effie. And I wanted it to be kind of a symbol to girls who had itchy feet husbands that if they just be patient, they'll always come back. You know, just don't be too demanding. Effie was just glad to see him. She loved him very, very much.
We loved the things that you did for us on the radio and television and in the movies and in vaudeville and on the boards, and we'll look forward to seeing you on the high wire at one of the circuses.
Oh,
one
definitely.
Of these
that's no. my next
that's
project.
That's the only thing that's left. Huh?
Oh, Lion Trainer or something like that.
Lorene Tuttle, thank you very much for sharing some memories with us today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.